Improve your construction projects with real-time insights direct from the site with Procore's easy-to-use platform. Learn more at Procore.com. Procore, software for the people who build the world.
It's Wednesday, the 15th of November, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, discussing some of the breaking construction news stories of the past couple of weeks. And I thought we'd start with the boring news today, Phil. The political news.
Well, there's a lot of it. You and I are talking, and just 5 minutes ago, the Supreme Court has said that we are not allowed to send people to Rwanda.
So I imagine you can still go on there. If you want to go on holiday to Rwanda, you're still allowed to go.
Yeah. But the government can't...
can't send you against your will, no.
Can't send people against their will. So that's all kicking off. And this, of course, is not unconnected to the government reshuffle, which has seen the departure of the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman. And, all sorts going on. In the wonderful world of politics.
Well, never a dull moment. I mean, it's been like that for a couple of years now, hasn't it?
It's been like that since 2010, I reckon. Ever since we had this coalition, which was like, in my lifetime, unheard of and groundbreaking and fascinating. So the whole machinations of the coalition was fascinating.
Yeah.
Then just when we thought it was all going to be, you know, steady and back to life as normal, we had the Brexit referendum.
Yeah.
And that was chaos for yonks. It remains semi-chaos, the whole Brexit fallout. And then COVID threw a spanner in the works and parties at number 10 and all that sort of stuff and three prime ministers in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
It's just been non-stop.
Oh, now we've come full circle, haven't we? We've got David Cameron back in the cabinet again.
Yes, the grown-ups back in the room. It's a curious one, that. I mean, I do tend to side with actually almost everything I read. I broadly agree with that. Any cabinet with David Cameron instead of Suella Braverman has got to be a better cabinet. I agree with that point that I've heard. Equally, I see that he doesn't come without baggage. It's hard to see exactly how it's going to change things.
Yeah,
but hey, it's all interesting.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And all right, and so in terms of construction, not an awful lot has changed, really. We've got a new housing minister, haven't we?
But we've always got a new housing minister. Number 16 in what is it, 13 years, 12 years?
10 years, I think.
Anyway, in not very long.
No, and he's been housing minister before, hasn't he? Lee Rowley, his name is.
That's his name. Yeah, Lee Rowley. He seems to be quite highly thought of. I haven't seen him speak or anything, but various people seem to hold him in high regard. He's very diligent and smart.
Yeah.
Gets things done and straight and down to earth. He was briefly housing minister when Liz Truss was prime minister for that 7 week period. But that was at a lower rank of junior minister, parliamentary under secretary of state, rather than minister of state, which he now is. He, as far as we know, I mean, whether he gets a planning brief or not is not clear. I mean, normally minister of state for housing is housing and planning. Mm-hmm. So presumably he's got that as well. But that wasn't in the government announcement. It just said housing. And he also is known to the construction industry because under his previous role as junior minister for local government, which is what he did. After he was junior minister for housing, he then became junior minister for local government in the same department.
Oh, right. Okay.
Leveling up department. So he's been doing that job for a while. But his remit as local government minister included the building safety brief, which is the whole building regs, post-Grenfell stuff. So that gives him a good eye and handle on housing as well, one would imagine.
Yeah.
Of course... It's not to be confused with the Minister for Construction.
Yes.
Who is someone completely different. That's a woman called Nusrat Ghani.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
She's in the Department for Business and Trade. And she's the woman who is the government side co-chair of the Construction Leadership Council. Mm-hmm. But her, although she's called the Construction Minister, and she stays in post, no change there, folks, she's not only the construction minister, she's basically the minister for pretty much all businesses, you know, including automotive, aerospace, professional services, you know, consultancy, minerals, steel.
Yeah, you name it.
So construction is not exactly her main focus. It's a little blip. Whereas I think that Lee Rowley in many ways is a more important minister as far as the construction industry is concerned, as for housing and planning.
Yeah.
Because he'll have a much greater influence in the months that he's got before the next election.
Yeah.
On the health and welfare of the construction industry. So he's got a lot to get on with. We haven't talked about the King's Speech, but the King's Speech happened just the day after, I think, we last spoke, David.
Or yes, that's right. It was, yeah.
And the King's Speech was, no, big part, just last week it was, not hardly anything of interest or relevance to construction, but quite a bit to do with housing, which is sort of interest secondarily to to construction interests, I suppose, including the leasehold and freehold bill and a renters reform bill. All sort of focus more on the tenants and customers buyer side of things rather than the builder side of things. And Rachel McLean, the previous housing minister, was looking forward to getting down to work, getting elbows into the business of all of that. And Lee Rowley will now pick up that. And every indication is it'll be, you know, as you were, more of the same. There's often a tendency, I was reading some article the other day, saying the problem with all these wretched reshuffles, I think it was Danny Finkelstein writing about his time with David Cameron and how David Cameron didn't like reshuffles, partly didn't like upsetting people by sacking them, and partly it was the idea that every time there's a new minister comes in, all the lobbyists go running to the door and go, "Oh, new person, listen to us, we've got a really good case," and manage to persuade them to undo stuff that's already been decided. And so there's even less continuity than there would be otherwise. I think at least with Lee Rowley, there's no reason to suppose there will be more flip-flopping on policy and up and downing on policy. There should be some continuity there. Because, of course, the problem with having all these change of ministers is that no one actually manages to get to grips with anything. And the lack of continuity means nothing gets done. I don't think we will suffer quite so much from the lack of continuity in this particular appointment is the point I'm trying to make.
Well, as you say, they've probably only got less than a year to run anyway, so we'll have to see. But the King's Speech, was a bit of a damp squib from the construction industry point of view, wasn't it? Because there was nothing really substantial there about projects or any changes to the industry. There was something about allowing, you know, more oil and gas drilling in the North Sea. That doesn't really affect the industry. As you say, the leasehold stroke freehold stuff and the tenants' rights has a sort of an oblique influence. And there was something on, we talked about this before, nutrient pollution, the rules on nutrient pollution, and we were hoping to see those restrictions lifted, but that didn't happen, did it?
No, I'm not quite sure where this is going to go. This again will be Lee Rowley to sort out, or maybe Michael Gove himself, the Secretary of State in that department, has been involved in it, as I understand it. Yeah, so they tacked on a clause or a couple of clauses to the levelling up bill when it was going through its last bits in the House of Lords in the summer, and the House of Lords said, nope, we're going to vote down those clauses, can't do that. Clauses that we've discussed before to change the current situation, which is, according to some inherited EU laws, you're not allowed to build on nutrient neutrality. Oh, you explain it, David. I've got a cold. I can't get my head around these things today.
Well, I'm no expert. It's something to do. It's basically about wastewater, isn't it? Going into watercourses. Yeah.
Yes. And I don't mean flood plains. I mean estuarial waters.
That's right. Yeah. And all this nutrient pollution from sort of treated sewage, I suppose, causing, you know, massive blooms of algae and stuff like that, is all rather messy and toxic and unpleasant and damages fragile ecosystems. And so there are very strict rules on development. And as we've mentioned before, it's not really the housing developers.
It's the bloody farmers,
isn't
it?
It's the farmers, yeah. But that doesn't make any difference. You're still not allowed to build in these areas without, I don't know, some sort of very severe mitigation built in. And in fact, I'm not even sure that mitigation is enough to let you off the hook. I don't know what the situation is at the moment, but I know that it really gets on the house builders' nerves and it is holding up a lot of developments. And so...
Here's my take on what's going on. Gove tacked on a clause onto the levelling up bill because it was an easy win if you could get it through. He couldn't get it through. And the expectation from the builders, the house builders and the developers, was that then he would have to bring forward separate legislation to debate it in the Parliament, get it through Commons, and the Lords couldn't really have overturned it because it had the heft of the democratically elected chamber behind it. And that was, it was all going to come through that way eventually. I think what Gove has done is twofold. One, no one's buying houses because they can't afford the mortgages because of interest rates. Mm-hmm. So there's not the same sort of panic over lack of house building as there had been a couple of years ago. And two, the Gove is, and the government in general have got so many other battles on that they're facing, not least over net zero and, mm-hmm. and the questions of their environmental credibilities, that putting themselves forward as a friend of polluters, this legislation might suggest that they are, was just not worth the bother,
yeah.
given the softer demand for new housing anyway.
Hmm.
That's my take on it.
Yeah, doesn't do anything to mollify the house builders though, because they're being told on the one hand, oh yes, you've got to keep building houses. You're not building enough houses. You know, you're sitting on land where you have permissions and you're not doing anything about it. And there's the law preventing them from developing areas because of this regulation. So I suppose that doesn't really help them.
But I think the house builder's bigger problem at the moment is interest rates.
Yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. So that was that. Nothing else in the King's speech to talk about. There's a Holocaust memorial being built, apparently, in Westminster. That was the only building project which he announced. I don't really know anything about that, but it's I wouldn't consider...
It's quite a big deal, and they've been talking about it for a long time and arguing about it in terms of the location, not about whether it should happen or not. But this is the patch of green land. If you're standing land side, not on the north side of the Palace of Westminster, looking at it, it's a patch of green on the right hand side.
Oh right,
on the riverbank next to the House of Lords end, and so it's lots of. Peers' secretaries probably walk their dogs on that patch
yes.
of land. So there's controversy about the location. And you'd have thought, actually, funnily enough, I was actually at the, not funnily enough, but coincidentally, I think I mentioned last week's podcast, I was just after Budapest, and I visited the largest synagogue in Europe when I was in Budapest.
Oh.
And it's a fascinating museum / memorial, I guess museum is the right expression, there to what went on in the ghetto of Budapest mm-hmm. and the horrors there. And I recommend that as a visit to anyone. And with all that's going on in the Middle East at the moment, it was a timely moment to
get a bit of context,
bone up on yeah. a bit of history and context
yeah.
and see what's going on. And I hope that the Holocaust Memorial doesn't attract the sort of negative attention which has been knocking around
no.
lately.
Are we going to move on to another topic?
Yeah, let's U-turn. So that the little change
yeah.
of subject there from construction to
yes.
other things.
To geopolitics.
Yeah, there seem to be a few stories that we've, news items that have posted in the past few days about machine technology, construction machinery technology. None of them are hugely new, but it's just a direction of travel. And if we take the first one, for example, we look at, it's about telematics, which has been around for yonks. If you bought a top-of-the-range, clever, expensive crane or digger, certainly mobile cranes, anything by Liebherr for 20 years has had, or more has had, telematics, which, you know, black box flight recorders, which record all the information.
Yeah.
You can, you know, remotely see what they're doing. You can check whether the operator is driving it properly, what the fuel consumption is, what it's lifting, what it's doing, all that stuff. And, and even in your fleet management software, you can say, oh, well, you know, all these machines are being very busy and these machines are standing idle. What's going on? And let's, you know, make things better. HS2 put something out, because HS2 is a project that's really keen to promote itself as the cutting edge of everything and driving industry improvement and so on and so forth. And we'll come on to other ways in which HS2 is maybe at the cutting edge later on in this pod. But at the moment, let's talk about the plant side of things. This story is that EKFB, which is a Eiffage, Kia, Ferrovial, Bam Nuttall joint venture, who have got the section between Chiltern Hills and Leamington Spa, they are using something called a Digital Graphical Earthworks Reporting Program, which they call
Handy acronym, that one.
You often think they have to reverse engineer acronyms.
Yeah, this actually makes quite good sense, doesn't it?
Digital Graphical Earthworks
Reporting.
Yeah,
it does what it says. Yeah.
And this is all, Finning, the Caterpillar dealer, the people who are basically behind this. They've got something called a Cubic Digital Platform, CUBIQ. That's probably an acronym as well, I guess. I have no idea. Anyway, basically what they're doing is they're harvesting all the data that comes out of their 700 odd earth moving machines, which I guess is diggers and trucks, maybe some loads as well, but diggers and trucks. And they're all fitted with electronic weight sensors, and they monitor all the material, the weight and volume of material that's dug out of the ground, stuck into a truck, moved somewhere else, dumped, etc., etc. And they've been able to analyze all of this data and make sure that everything is moving in the right place at the right time to optimize efficiency. And bottom line is they've reduced costs, they reckon, by about 25 million, which is a lot.
That is a lot.
They're saying a significant slice of that comes from reduced fuel consumption.
Right, okay.
So it's you know, efficient movement of vehicles. 25 million pounds of
diesel, that's an awful lot. It's a few swimming pools.
Or carrot juice, chip fat oil. But that's a lot. They've moved 27 million cubic meters of spoil to date, and they're about halfway through. So basically, for every million cubic meters, they're saving £1 million by understanding, interpreting, and using the data. Now, why I find this interesting is because we've had telematics for so long, why has it taken so long? And maybe other people do. I'm sure other people do use this, but there probably hasn't been a project of this scale.
That's what I think. I think that's the story.
This scale of saving. Yeah. There must have been a lot of earth moving at Hinkley Point, but I guess Hinkley Point was probably by and large flattish, whereas, you know, on HS2, there's an awful lot of cuttings and what they call green tunnels, which is basically a cutting with a lid on, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot of earth moving on HS2. So it's maybe not that this is new technology, it's just the most extreme or extreme sounds a harsh word to use, but the most extravagant or exploitative use of it that we've seen in the UK.
I mean, they've clearly used the technology and they've set up their own system, haven't they? So, I mean, other people won't be doing exactly the same thing in exactly the same way.
I think it's Finning's system, though. I think Finning are the I don't say the brains, it's probably Caterpillar, but I don't think it's an HS2 system or even a EKFB system particularly. Well,
but this digger thing isn't Finning's, is it? Or is it? Am I getting that wrong?
I'm not sure. The way I interpret it is it's the data comes out of the machines.
Yes.
Who are, well, it's got, the picture we've used is Walter's excavator that's at work there.
Okay.
But it's the plant hire companies and the subcontractors, the earth moving contractors, who own the machines. And it's Finning who have got who provide the service of
Yeah.
They already offer a sort of monitoring service for companies. And it's their ability to interpret the data is how I see it.
Well, I assumed that EKFB had basically just set up a bit of software in their offices to process the information provided by the finning system. So I thought it was just, you know, their back end, if you like. But I don't know whether that's a bit of bespoke software or whether it's they just plugged it into a Microsoft bit of Microsoft software and put
Excel
it on there.
Spreadsheet.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But I mean, clearly people should be doing this sort of thing, especially if you're making savings of this sort of magnitude. So I agree with you. I'd be surprised to hear that nobody's done anything like this before. But I assume that the news peg here is that it's being done on a perhaps a bigger scale than anybody's done it before, but it's a big job. That's why.
And we've talked before about how people with stuff to sell are always saying, oh, the construction industry is not, you know, it needs to be more digital.
Yes, that's right.
And we said, well, it is digital. It's loads of digital stuff in construction, lots of digits. But what this shows, I think, is that while there's loads of digital capability, it's not often exploited as much as it could be.
Yeah.
And I think we do need to get better at using the data that we have available. That I think a lot of people who buy a machine. I remember, as you know, David, because you edited the same magazine as I did, but 20 years ago, I was editing a crane magazine, a lifting equipment magazine. And I started asking around. Lipo was saying how great they were, that all the machines came with these great telematics and everything. And I would ask the owners of Lipo cranes, do you use these telematics? And they go, not really.
Oh, really? Okay.
it does mean they use it to the extent that if the thing, on the whole, they didn't break down. It was normally the operator or the driver or someone who'd do something wrong. The dog who's sitting in the seat beside him forgot to bark when he pushed the wrong button. And they can ring up Leap Air, and Leap Air can remotely say, you need to pull that plug out, or you need to push that button. So they used it for the factory backup to call for help.
Yeah.
But I don't think they particularly used it much to
not in a proactive way. No, exactly. Yes. But I don't think that's. I think that's entirely understandable because I'm guilty of exactly the same. I'm sure most people are. I mean, occasionally my phone will send me a message and say, "Do you know if you do this, you can do such and such?" And I thought, well, no, I didn't know I could do that. It's quite handy, a few of these shortcuts. Everybody's got a phone these days, which is capable of an enormous amount of processing and, you know, help to, you know, make your life a lot easier and all the rest of it. And I think that a tiny minority of people actually exploit the full capability of their technology, you know, their phone or their laptop or their tablet.
But a lot of it is trust. On a quite simple level, my oven, you can set it, and I'm sure lots of people got an oven like this, you can set it to come on in 5 hours' time or something. So I can put my joint of beef or my nut roast, other dishes are available, in the oven, you know, before I leave the house in the morning, you know, come home at 6 o'clock in the evening, and, you know, there it is, cooked to perfection, take it out. I'm not going to trust it to do that on its own.
No, that's a bit scary, that oven coming on its own, no. Especially if you can't get home in time. But
what, there is that. Yes.
No, I mean, I've got an oven that used to do that until the clock broke and I didn't bother getting it fixed. But I didn't know. It was my daughter who actually pointed this out to me, because I had pressed some wrong buttons and noticed that the oven had come on at some point when I didn't want it to. Who put the oven on? And Flo said, well, maybe you programmed it, Dad. Yeah, somebody's programmed it. And so obviously,
I can't program anything.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a classic situation of confused old git not understanding their technology and being completely outfoxed by the younger generation. But there we are. But yeah, well, there you are. That's something else, a capability that either you don't want or you don't trust or don't even know about. So maybe this story, EKFB using telematics in a proactive and really, really productive way, is simply an example of the technology actually being exploited to its maximum capacity.
I wonder even if it is to its maximum capacity. I bet there's data that the machines are pumping out that can tell them even more and that can be exploited even more. Yeah. I don't know what it might be, but, you know.
So that was quite interesting. And there are other technology stories that you've run in the last week or so, Phil, which are...
Well, yes, the day after that, there was another one on from a different HS2 contractor, Balfour Beatty Vinci.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as so often with these things, it's people down the supply chain who are the brains behind the operation and deserve the credit. This is a company called GCP Applied Technologies, who are a US company. GCP, they were acquired by Saint-Gobain last year. And
big materials group.
Big fancy materials group. And as part of the deal, what GCP's Applied Technologies, one of their things that they have is something called Verify, with an I on the end. Mm-hmm. Verify In-Transit Concrete Management, which is basically tech for concrete mixers that automatically adds water and admixture as required to maintain a pre-programmed quality of slump in the truck, in the mixer, so that when it arrives on site, what arrives on site is what the customer asked for. So you don't have to do your cone tests and waste material on cone tests and waste time on that. And if it's a fail, you know, dump it, start again, new mix and whatever. So it's basically a quality assurance guaranteeing that the right stuff turns up and you can use it. And Balfour Beatty Vinci have been testing this with two of their concrete suppliers, Tarmac and Aggregate Industries, on their bit of HS2. But I thought, it doesn't sound that high tech to me. It sounds great. It sounds useful. And again, you kind of think, why weren't we doing this 20 years ago?
Yeah.
How complicated is it?
I think it's slightly different from the earth moving one, the digger.
Yes, it is.
Thing. In that... it's basically a sort of an electronic sort of dosing system, isn't it? It sort of adds. I'm sure that food manufacturers use this all the time.
Well, part one is monitoring it. Part one is you test it, detectors to test it and check it,
and then dosing it to correct.
And the then mix. Dosing, yeah, it yeah. In response.
Well, that
to
is
it,
quite yeah. interesting. Here, you talked about not trusting the technology, and I just wondered. Because basically, you get this concrete arriving on site, and it's being tested and monitored electronically, and it's so you can tell your client that exactly the mix that they require, the right sort of strength, and all the rest of it. But I mean, I don't know enough about concrete technology, but I know that you know you make cubes, don't you? You do cube tests and you test
cones. They talk about cones.
Well, there's cones. I think cones are something to do with slump. You mentioned slump, and yeah. I think maybe here we are, you know, displaying our ignorance. But I think always thought that a cone test was where you. Get the uncured concrete, mold it into a cone, and then see how much it slumps, and just measure that. Presumably, I mean workability. I don't know, but I got the impression from this, and maybe I misread it, that you didn't have to do strength tests on it. You'd get the guaranteed strength from the cured concrete. And I might be wrong. I mean, cube tests. You make these cubes in special molds, and then you test them by squashing them and. Find out how many newtons of force you need to apply to crunch the concrete up. I got the impression that it did away with that, and maybe I'm wrong. If I am wrong, then apologies. Maybe it's just to do with the workability of the mix, and you still have to do your strength test later on. But I thought that that sort of computerization of the mixing process was already in place. You know, we talked recently, within the last year or so, of that outfit whose name I can't remember, who do a do-it-yourself batching plant where you can go into a...
Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And I should know. I should be able to remember who they are. And apologies to them for not remembering their name. But basically, it's a you go into your local builder's merchant. They've got this batching plant set up, and you dial in your mix, your recipe, and it mixes it for you, and then delivers it straight to your truck. So clearly, it's a similar technology that they this is mixed by computer. It's completely automated. So I assume that this must be a similar sort of thing. Whether or not it will guarantee the final strength of the mix, I don't know. I was assuming that it didn't.
So I'm just looking up. I thought there was a... I'd posted a video on our news report here, but there isn't one. But I'm sure I saw... I'll have to dig out and see if there was a video of the of Verify in Action somewhere on the GCP's website, perhaps. And if there is, I will add it to the report that we've already posted. But that does seem an interesting thing. But it's been around a while. I mean, Balfour Beatty Vinci, HS2, I should say, is saying, well, you know, we're at the forefront, we're at the cutting edge. But actually, as I mentioned in our piece, Extruder Curb have been using it.
Oh, yes.
Used it last year on a project. And they have it. They have the tech fitted to one or more of their trucks. There are other people, I'm sure, as well as Extruder Curb. But that's, interesting tech.
Yeah, definitely. And there was a third story as well, another story that you wrote. But this again, is not new technology, and this is self-driving vehicles, isn't it?
Yes, this is unrelated. And we've done bits and pieces over the past few years about Caterpillar and Volvo and I think Komatsu. And often they're involved self-driving construction vehicles. And often they've been involved in... either mines in Australia or underground, you know, places with a sort of a confined ambit. I say it's all construction sites of a confined area, but
yeah,
but big open cast mines have a particular type of provide a particularly good laboratory for testing machines, I suppose. This is a Dynapac soil compactor being used on a dam project in British Columbia in Canada. And there have been other self-driven soil compactors, as I understand it. So this isn't completely a first. But this press release that we got, the story came from Trimble Earthworks.
Yeah.
Trimble Earthworks, grade control platform for autonomous compactors. Is that the first... It's Trimble's first test of a fully autonomous soil compactor on a live construction site. That's a particular thing. They've done tests in,
you know,
in their backyard and whatever. And it's, I want to call, I don't like calling them compactors. They're steamrollers. I know there's no steam anywhere, but you know, in old money, they're steamrollers, but they're not driven by steam. Road roller. Anyway, it completed 37 hours of real compaction work, operating alongside a mixed fleet of compactors, the rest of which were all running the Trimble blah 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 compaction control system. They compared the data from all the machines, both with and without an operator, and basically found that the driverless one was, they're not saying it's better than with the operator, but it seems to be, you know, it passes the test just as good.
We've heard a lot about self-driving cars, haven't we, you know, in recent years, so the technology is out there and it's getting more mainstream. But I think, again, Caterpillar, haven't they been selling rigid dump trucks to mining companies which are self-driving? Is that actually a thing now, or are they?
I think it's still on a sort of yes, they've been happening, but I think if you look it up, it's still on a pilot basis, I should
right.
call it. I don't think you can go down to your local Caterpillar dealer. You can't ring up Finning and say, can you send me a driverless Caterpillar dump truck, please?
No, not yet.
Oh, right. Okay. Happy to have this conversation. Where are we going to use it? What are we going to do? And, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they're not readily on the market yet.
I suppose the thing is that somewhere like an open cast mine is probably a much safer place to have driverless vehicles, even if they're massive rigid dump trucks around than, you know, say the M25, for example. So I think that, and, you know, this Dynapac machine obviously being used in a place where if it does go a bit AWOL, it's not going to be a completely disastrous event.
Well, if it damages something, no one else knows about it, and it only damages your kit.
Yes, exactly.
My problem with self-driving cars, I quite like the idea of them, but I read in the papers last week that you're still going to have to be sober. It's not a license to get home from the pub after you've had a few. There has to be someone in control of a driverless car, not just a computer.
Yeah.
So why bother? If you can't take advantage of it, I suppose you can, you know.
Well, yeah, what can you do? Sort of
light your pipe or read the paper or something while you're doing it. But
if you're reading the paper, you're not paying attention.
I don't think you have to pay attention. You just have to be.
How can you be in charge if you're not paying attention?
Oh, good point. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like the idea of driverless cars, I have to admit.
Do you even get rowed on the Docklands Light Railway, David?
Yes, I have used a Docklands Light Railway. And the Gatwick shuttle. So I have been on a driverless vehicle before. But it's on rails, and if it's on rails, it can't veer off to the side all of a sudden.
I worked at Heron Quay when this is before Olympia and York had even started their piling at Canary Wharf.
Right.
And one of the first things to go in was the Docklands Light Railway, and that was my, from Tower Gateway to Heron Quay, was my commute every morning. And it was very exciting when that came on the scene. You could get all the way to the bottom of the Isle of Dogs and this modern, high-tech, whizzy.
Where did you pick it up?
Railway.
Was there a link to the Northern Line or something?
Tower Gateway, which was the District and the Circle line.
Right,
it was a walk from a couple hundred yards walk from Tower Bridge Tube Station to next to Royal Mint, where the Docklands Light Railway ended.
Climb into the future.
It was very Marty McFly. That was the 80s, 1980s.
Yes. But I think a driverless train is one thing, driverless cars and driverless dump trucks, maybe something else.
I suppose I'll just give a quick mention to a very, very different, well, on the subject of a construction plant and tech. This is quite a simple one, but cute device that Nationwide Platforms have come up with. And Nationwide Platforms have done one or two things in the world of powered access safety devices. And this one is what they call their harness on system, which is basically that unless you have the lanyard of your harness clipped onto a certain smart hook on point on the frame of the platform, the control box doesn't work. It's immobilized, and you can only, and you kind of by clipping onto the platform box or beside the box, it enables the thing to work, which is just a way of making sure that if you're in a boom lift, you have to clip your harness on properly.
Yeah.
And I suppose it doesn't check that you're actually wearing the harness, but if you go into the effort of clipping it on, you might as well be wearing the harness on.
Yeah.
And this is necessary because, as has become apparent over the years, telescopic boom lifts are quite prone to being bouncy if the base is hit by a passing truck or something, or if the operator decides to travel in it when they're in the basket's elevated and they hit a pothole.
You get flicked out.
Boing, boing, boing.
Yeah.
And there have been horrible incidents of operators being flicked out.
Yeah.
And so now best practice is to wear a harness and detach yourself. And Nationwide have gone one further, saying, look, you're not just saying wear a harness, they're saying, actually, this machine won't work unless you wear a harness. And clip on.
Again, I don't think that's new. I think Nationwide developed that years ago. I went on a Nationwide course actually. Probably about 10 years ago about managing.
Well, they've just won an award for it this year.
Have they?
I think it's a new iteration of it.
So oh right, okay, yeah, I know
so,
that.
Anyway, you went.
No, I went on a course about how to manage MEWP operations. I even got a certificate saying I was qualified, which was a bit frightening because I certainly didn't feel competent. But anyway, any competence I had has lapsed now. No, and then they did talk about this, and it was quite horrifying. You know, some of the accidents that have happened. I mean, you've got a large boom lift, and if it goes over in travel mode, if it goes over something like a speed bump, just the rocking of the chassis can flick you out of the basket, and I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that they had that system back then, that you had to have a harness on and you had to be tethered. Otherwise, you couldn't operate the machine. So maybe they've done...
It, do, it,
Go on.
It didn't used to immobilise it, though. It didn't immobilise the machine. I think that's new.
Oh, well, maybe, yeah. Probably. Okay.
You certainly had to have a harness. You know, the rules are you have to have a harness on for safety. But still, a lot of people didn't. I think this harness on system is the tech which immobilises the machine if you don't.
I mean, maybe cars one of these days will, you know, at the moment, if you don't put your seatbelt on, you get you get nagged. But maybe they'll fit immobilisers to them. So you have to have your seatbelt on, otherwise the car won't go. Anyway, I interrupted you. You were going to talk about something.
Well, I should just to give it the correct news peg, because they haven't developed it this week. They have developed it before and have amended it, perfected it, whatever. This week, Wilmot Dixon has come out and said, we are mandating the use of this on our sites. Mm-hmm. No boom lifts can be used unless they have this harness-on system. That it's not going to be possible to drive any boom lifts without this tech. Therefore, there will be no unharnessed operators of boom lifts on our site. And while they're not the only people to have used it, Balfour Beatty have been testing the thing last year or earlier this year, I'm not sure when. But Wilmot Dixon reckon they're the first tier one contractor to actually mandate it, to say this is compulsory.
Okay.
And I think others will follow. That's quite unusual. I mean, nothing wrong with Wilmot Dixon as a company at all. But they're not normally first in line for these sort of things. If I was going to guess who was going to be the first in line for anything to do with plant safety, I'd say Balfour Beatty or Lang O'Rourke are right at the front end of this. And I would have thought they would be the first in. Because Wilmot Dixon don't have their own plant. I mean, Balfour Beatty don't have their own power effort. No contractors really have their own mupes, particularly. They all hire them in. But yeah, you don't think of Wilmot Dixon as being at the cutting edge of plant. So this is interesting. So all credit to, I guess it's Mark French, who is their health and safety chief at Wilmot Dixon. He's certainly the man quoted in the announcement they put out. So I suppose it's his initiative.
Yes, so well, why not? You know, it's a no-brainer, really. I should just say that I've checked. It's Phoebo Collect was the company that does the drive-through batching plants. So I thought I'd better give them a name check. And doing very well, apparently, I believe. Yeah.
Phoebo Fibo Farm.
Yeah, so doing very well, rolling it out across the UK now. So should we move on to our final topic, Phil?
Yeah, we mentioned earlier about HS2 being at the cutting edge. How wonderful they are sponsoring new things. We completely different story about HS2 this morning. A bunch of people, including John Armitt, the head of the National Infrastructure Commission, and Nick Smallwood, the head of the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, and a couple of other Mandarini-type people, were in front of the Treasury Select Committee yesterday to talk about the topic of infrastructure and various things. And I confess I haven't yet had a chance to listen to the whole 3-hour session, 2.5-hour session of it.
Saving
but
that.
I listened to the first half hour, and it was fascinating to hear Nick Smallwood, he's the chief executive of the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, that's the government body, sort of part of the Treasury, that hybrid working, i.e. working from home, had caused substantial delays to the design work needed for HS2. And the committee, the chair of the committee, the select committee in the House of Commons, sort of quizzed him on that. Said, so working from home has done this. And says, well, yeah, not just HS2, obviously. Working from home is slowing down all infrastructure projects, he said. Now, we've talked before often about the benefits of work-life balance and hybrid working and how you and I always think we get more work done at home than in an office where you're surrounded by people who want to talk about the football results with you and other things you might not be interested in. And at home, you just get your head down and get on with the job. But this guy is firmly of the opinion, I mean, he would say it's more than the opinion, he would say he was talking in such a way that he had some sort of evidence to back it up, that designers who go into the office and work collaboratively with their colleagues, the duration of design work getting done, pretty normal. quote, what we've seen post-pandemic is a 9 to 12 month extension of those durations, design, as in duration of design time, things taking up to a year longer because people are working from home instead of working collaboratively in teams. Now, of course, 6 months, year's time, it won't matter because it'll all be being done by AI, I guess. but at the moment, while people are still designing things, big infrastructure projects, huge delays, which I've not heard anyone come out and say that before. And if this is the his view, he should be telling the Construction Leadership Council, getting standing up at industry conferences and events saying, look, everyone, get back to the office. Yeah. Of course, site workers are all on site. We know that. But designers are still a lot of home working from home. And if he's right, it cannot be allowed to carry on.
No.
Designers have got to get back to the office, if he's right.
Over what sort of period of time was this studied? I mean, I suppose it must have been since 2020 when the lockdown started, because we've had people who work from home occasionally in the past, but it became institutionalized, really, didn't it? It became even the phrase hybrid working didn't really exist before COVID-19, and it's become just the way people do. I mean, my two oldest kids, both in London, both in different types of jobs, they both work in the office between 2 and 3 days a week, and the rest is done at home.
Yeah, that's pretty normal, I think.
Impression. I think it's pretty normal now. So I suppose they must have an awful lot of data if they can say that. I mean, 9 to 12 month extension for design projects. What are they comparing? You know, they're comparing similar. I suppose they must have found similar infrastructure projects before the pandemic and after the pandemic and made comparisons between them. But they must have had an awful lot of projects to compare.
I don't even know. I have to listen to more of the session, the committee inquiry session to find out. Or I don't even know if there was a firm study. Maybe I'll drop him an email this afternoon.
Yeah.
If there's a firm study, or whether it's just him sort of, wetting a finger and sticking it up in the air and feeding the flow of things and what he reckons. He does look a particularly old school sort of person.
And maybe a young hipster. Oh, no, he's got no hair in the moustache.
Maybe a young hipster type. We'd kind of be extolling the benefits of hybrid work and how the designs are much better now because they're all working from home and everyone's much happier and it's all great, the designs now.
Yeah.
An element of his own sort of age-related prejudices coming out. I don't know.
If he's looking at, say, a bridge on the HS2 project and then looked at the paperwork and thought, well, bloody hell, they should have done that in 6 weeks. You know, why have they taken a year? Well, that's an opinion, isn't it? I mean, it's an informed opinion, but it's not statistics. It's not data. So I think it would be interesting to see how they've come to that conclusion and on the basis of what evidence. Because an opinion is one thing, but evidence is entirely different. And he might be right.
I was just doing a quick Google to see whether his opinion mattered or meant anything, whether he was a career civil servant who only knew about working in offices or he's actually done something. He has actually done something. He's former vice president for projects engineering and chief projects engineer at Shell. So, not construction, but big engineering.
Sure.
So he knows about designing big stuff. So let's give him the credit for having an opinion worth listening to, this guy.
Yeah.
But he said that, as I say, it was particularly reference to HS2, but it said it's not just HS2, it's everything. But this working from home, this hybrid working, was a big part of why the IPA have given HS2 Phase 1 a red alert warning in their latest assessment to all the infrastructure projects. Red alert basically means that it ain't going to be done on time or on budget. We have no confidence it can be done on time or on budget. And he says that working from home, there was an initial underestimation at the beginning of the project of the amount of design work required. So there's more design work than they thought there was. And the reason why they can't meet it on cost is because of the huge cost inflation in the price of materials.
Yes. It's
clearly outside of the control of HS2, so no one blames them for that. But if they've misestimated, underestimated the amount of design work required, and then they're letting everyone sit at home doing the design work. Something needs to change.
Well, it'll be interesting. One of the first guests we ever had on the podcast, if you remember, was
TimeWise woman.
Yes, Emma Stewart. Emma Stewart was her name.
That's right.
Co-founder of TimeWise. Very very persuasive woman, and you know, she advises people now on flexible working. And in fact, I believe that your wife is also involved in that side of the business. She also advises
more,
people.
Not less on the side that TimeWise does, not in terms of setting up flexible working, but if you're how to manage people who are working from home and remote. So, but yes,
well, maybe that's the issue.
They're
not being managed properly. But I mean, the whole concept of hybrid working has spawned businesses set up to facilitate that. And as you said, it's the way it's done these days. So I'd be surprised. Maybe it's just in some aspects of work. You know, maybe engineering design is not best suited to home working. Maybe things like journalism are fine, but design isn't. I don't know. But
I think when you particularly use the word collaboration and collaborative working, so I think that's the point, is that collaboration is an essential ingredient in design.
Yes, it certainly is in I think in some jobs and also in some stages of your career. For example, you and I, Phil, we've had a belly full of collaborative working, having worked in offices for years and years and years. And actually, I'm not speaking for you, but I'm sure you'd agree with me that actually working from home on your own without the interference of colleagues is actually preferable. But my son, for example, who was working exclusively from home for the first 2 years of his career after leaving university.
Oh, that's no good.
Hated it. Yeah, absolutely hated it. He now works for a company where he has to get on a tube and go to work 3 days a week. And he's much happier because he's on a steep learning curve at the moment. He needs to learn from his peers. He needs to interact with his colleagues. He cannot thrive without that interaction. So I think that it's horses for courses, really. You know, some people will be able to work extremely efficiently and quite happily in isolation, whereas others need that interaction. They need that office environment. They need the people around them to operate.
But the suggestion here is not just whether it's about age or the stage of your career. It's also the work that you're doing.
Yeah.
And if it's design work, which is very different from what you and I do. I mean, it's very hard to write an article when you've got someone over your shoulder going, oh, put that word in. Oh, don't put that word in.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Get away. But design work, I can see how it's an iterative process.
Yes.
And it should be backwards and forwards. Now, why that iterative process cannot be conducted just effectively, whether it's by email or Zoom or shared working platforms, I don't entirely see. As I say, I intend to ask the IPA for more information about how Nick Smallwood has arrived at his opinion.
Yeah,
is it just a sense of prejudice, or is there some science behind this? And if there's some science behind this, then I don't know what authority he's got to do anything about it, because he doesn't run the construction industry at all, but is an influential person. But someone has got to maybe write it in public contracts that if you want to design this next, you know, National Highways job, you've got to be sitting in an office with other people and not at home.
Rishi Sunak's quite keen on getting people back into the office, isn't he?
A lot of government ministers are, and yet a lot of government departments, I mean, they can't even get their own departments back to office. I can't remember the exact stats that I've been reading. But there are major government departments which have still only got about 30% of people back in the office.
Yeah.
And like you were saying with your son, 3 days in the office is pretty much the norm, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go to any station car park on a Monday or Friday in a commuter town around the home counties and compare that to, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and you'll see the difference.
Yeah.
Anyway, you mentioned, going back to our initial subject of the reshuffle, you mentioned a former guest on this podcast. We should say congratulations to another former guest of this podcast, which is Sakib Bharti MP, the MP for Meriden in the Black Country. He came on to talk about HS2, as it happens, was it earlier this year?
That's right.
About some of the consultation process and some of the issues he had with HS2's consultation processes. He's got a government job. He is now a junior minister in the Department for Science. Is it called Science and Technology?
Technology and Digital Economy, I think, isn't it? Is it?
Yes, you're right. The Department of Technology and Digital Economy is one of these new departments that's just created last year. So he's on the bottom rung of the on his ministerial career. Unfortunately, as we discussed, I don't think he'll be. The government will be around long enough to see him climb much higher this time around. But I think he's
as long as he holds on to his seat, he'll have another bite of the cherry later.
Exactly, The power of the pod. We got him his job. Right, I've noticed one or two people have taken up our plea for telling people, passing on the about the existence of this podcast, Reconstruction. Having said that... Elsewhere on social media, I got some flack for talking about an £85 million shed going up in somewhere or other. I wouldn't call it a shed if it was in his back garden. You can't call it a shed. This person obviously doesn't know about the concept of beds and sheds as a broad category. If it's a warehouse, it's a shed, folks.
Yes.
I know it's different from a garden shed, but beds and sheds is a concept.
Yeah.
Anyway, but there's been lots of chat about the Reconstruction podcast on some of the social media. I've been saying it's been great. So keep it up and pass the word. Leave us a review, give us loads of stars, and send us an email, please, to podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But for another week, David, is that us? Are we done?
And that's it, I think, yeah.
Alrighty, so thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.